Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today, we have a bit of a gaming special with a post on CSGO and a Factorio buffer overflow, as well as a Chromecast secure boot bypass and a Linux bug. So, yeah, we'll start off with our gaming-based topics. It's an active made a post on exploring Counter-Strike Global Offensive's attack surface. Obviously, Global Offensive has been superseded by CS2, but this research is a little bit old. This was back from like their research in 2021, but where it's the source engine and where it's Valve code, that's probably not changed very much anyway. So a lot of it is probably still relevant. I'll let Z get into it.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I would totally agree with you on the CS2 aspect. So I genuinely don't know how the development of CS2 went. You know, was it, I guess they mentioned here in the post, actually, CSGO is built on the source engine. Did they do anything newer? Because I thought with CS2, they were like going to something new.
So CS2 does move to Source 2. That said, from what I've heard, Source 2 is not really that much different than Source 1, at least in some of the more benign things like networking stuff and whatnot. Like, I don't think that stuff has changed too much, right?
Yeah, fair. Which, fair enough. I mean, if the networking code is, I mean, given the fact that they found the issues, maybe it's not solid. It would make sense to kind of copy and paste networking code and focus more on the graphical aspects. Since the big thing there is, you know, it is the game engine and kind of the graphical aspect of that kind of matter. So fair enough. Maybe it hasn't changed as much, but either way, they do go into quite a bit of the attack surface overview, have various pieces of information about how that works, which I'm not going to get into. We'll get into what they did here, which looks like this is mostly just fuzzing. And also, I should shout out that this is back in 2021, and specifically during our 6-month reverse engineering internship. So kind of sounds like a great way to spend at least part of their internship. They said, you know, for approximately 25 days or, you know, 5 work weeks just doing reverse engineering or this sort of side project. I guess they do mention that this is a side research project different from the main subject, but they had the time presumably given to them to work on something like this, which is just kind of cool to see the company offering that as part of what they're offering in the internship. And there are a number of security companies that have that. I know we've covered actually posts from Trail of Bits before and their interns doing some research. So I don't know. I always like to see it and like to call it out when we do, in case you're actually thinking about getting an internship somewhere, getting into the field that way. You know, looks pretty interesting to me as an option. Anyway.
Yeah. Sorry, just jumping back really quick. I didn't catch this on my first read through. It was part of their like red message banner, which for some reason, like, it's red, it should stand out at you, but I sometimes skip it. So they do say that the code that was impacted here is no longer present in CS2. So maybe there's a bit more differences than I thought, but I mostly stand by my point still. But in this specific case, that vuln seems like it's not present in CS2 anymore, which is a little bit relevant because, as we'll probably get to after you cover the issue, Valve bug bounty fun timeline stuff. There was a lot of back and forth on that. But yeah, I did just want to quickly mention that this isn't really relevant for CS2 on the vulnerability.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I don't know why. Yeah, I also just kind of glossed over the nice warning header at the top. Something about always seeing like those cookie warnings probably just made me ignore this random box in the middle of my content. I don't know.
That's probably what it is. Yeah.
Or just, you know, those random boxes that'll show up kind of made me gloss over it. Anyway, they've set up a fuzzer, I guess, running AFL++, trying to fuzz. Looks like they focused on the file formats that could be shared between, or that they could cause a random client to download or somebody connect to like their server. So in this case, the vulnerability was in a MDL file, which is one of their model files. And they talk, after about 2 nights of fuzzing, they had around 100 unique crashes. So that does give you an idea of code quality here. Although the majority of them were just out of bounds reads, which had access from unchecked offsets, which is what they kind of call out, and did not look interesting, which, fair enough, out of bounds reads. Sometimes you get lucky and it's like genuinely just like out of bound read and it gives you that value back. But a lot of out of bound reads end up being like they're going to read some value and do some other work based off of it. And unless you can catch the difference that happens between different values, they can be really hard to actually abuse without some sort of side channel where you can derive some of the information.
Especially remotely in games like this.
Yeah, like it's rough. So I mean, out of bounds read can be useful, but when it comes from a crash, a lot of crashes do end up not being super useful. Like they might be something you could do something with, but it's just so minor that it's hard to imagine. Just look for better bugs. In which case they, kept going and had another, or kept looking through their crashes at least, and had another bug that was an out of bounds write that looked more exploitable and more interesting. And they've got the code up here where I guess they've got kind of the couple files here showing different pieces of the code, but the main location where you actually have an issue is in this PStudio header 2 function. All it's supposed to do is just return you this studio header 2 T or type, and that is based off of, they have some this object and it's just adding a index value into it. This index value comes from the model file itself. Taking a look at this file here, the PStudio header is calculating the offset, or the function is returning at some offset. That value is coming from the attacker. Offhand, I'm not sure if there was too much of a constraint on what this value could be. However, there was definitely a constraint on the value that would be written. So you'll see that this header 2 function that has this out of bounds is in this case a read, actually, returning the object. That then gets used by the set virtual model function, which takes in a void star pointer, and then it will set the somewhat controllable offset here, or at that offset to whatever that value is. And that value is has 16 bits that are controlled by the attacker, and then the upper 16 bits of the 32-bit value are not controlled by the attacker. They'll just be zero because of a, I believe it gets typecasted from like the 16 over to an unsigned 32-bit, giving you rough control, or yeah, rough control over the value. You can definitely do a lot with that sort of out of bounds write, but it is a restriction having kind of the start with the null bytes depending on what you try and do with this. Unfortunately, the exploitation of this bug, it sounds like, or to me, it sounds like they basically went, looked for the bug itself, and just considered finding the bug that looks exploitable to be a win, and didn't go through with the full exploitation flow. So what ended up happening is they come back to this some months later. I want to say it was like, yeah, months after the initial vulnerability research, we've decided to look back at into the only bug found looking viable for exploitation. And they dedicated a week to just trying to do that, which is looking at the exploitation of this. And they did not take it to full exploitation. They say it looks exploitable because you've got that relative, you're in the heap, so a relative heap out of bounds write with a somewhat controllable value. So there's definitely options for corrupting that, or for corrupting something with that. So they're looking at the exploitation. They talk about what, like, the normal sort of, or actually first they talk about even triggering this, where if somebody connects to a community game or community server, the server will provide like this downloadables list. The expected action would be that the client will download any missing resources from the server given this list. However, that will only happen if the configuration is, or of SV allow upload option is enabled, and that is not the default option as of February 2018. The default option is that won't allow that. However, most community servers require that clients actually enable that, so it isn't uncommon to see a client connecting to a server that would have that configuration enabled and allowing it to go forward. But they would use the downloadable list, provide a file, and or provide their list of things, and they can add a model in there and indicate that they just need the bounds of that checked. Which means for models, and when I say checking the bounds, there's two options. Either it'll do just a hash or a CRC over the file to compare it, or consistency bounds, that option will load the model and perform some size checks on the actual model itself, which means it's going to parse the model in order to perform that bound check, meaning it will trigger, this parsing bug. So that's how they can get the remote aspect. Getting into the exploitation, they kind of talk about the typical steps needed for this. You want to be able to groom something so it's located next to, or at least reachable from, their relative, right? Gain a relative memory leak or something by overwriting like a size value in this object or a pointer in order to bypass ASLR, arbitrary memory read primitive, hopefully without needing to droom anything again. So if they can gain it out of the same object, that's kind of useful, but, you know, abuse those two things to get your arbitrary write or write while where primitive and gain code execution from there. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the route that they actually would be able to go with what they found. They do a little bit of research into the possible primitives, where one of them being a heap string primitive. Fair enough. Looks like this CNAP message, player avatar data, is useful for spraying because player avatar information stays in memory. It's persisted there, and it can be of arbitrary size. So whatever size you need to spray in, you can get that with a lot of control over that value. But the other primitive they were able to find was just this write to a fixed memory location. The idea being that in the data section, G underscore size pre-localized mini string, or sorry, SZ, so Hungarian notation there. And it is just a 512 character array that gets written to it, or that it will end up writing to. So in theory, you know, you could write to that specific location. You kind of have a primitive to write to that using this show menu message. But I think part of the problem there is that if CSGO is a like Py executable or whatever it's called on in Windows world, you're going to run into the issue that that's not necessarily going to be a fixed address anymore where they can write to. So it's going to always write to that location. Like it will, this function will always write to the same location, but you do still need a way to actually reveal what that location is. Like still need to leak it somehow, which if they found any sort of leak, perhaps they'd then be able to do that. But the process of exploiting that's going to be a bit different than the typical steps required that they talk about. So I don't know, it feels a little bit weird to me that their primitives don't match up with their, or at least in my mind, they don't match up. Perhaps they are, you know, reading things a bit differently and in their head it makes sense. But I would have liked to have seen them at least talk about what their potential thing would have been with the primitives they found. But with these primitives, like it is missing some steps and that's going to be a bit of a challenge for the actual exploitation. But with more research, probably could find at least some way to exploit this. I mean, there's a lot of complex code going on. There's a lot of things going on that you would be able to potentially take advantage of. I don't know if there's a bucketing in the allocator being used here of size is going to be a issue in terms of available targets or anything. That's kind of another consideration that isn't raised. Nonetheless, bit of a fun bug in terms of getting their out-of-bounds right. So I figured we'd bring this up here, and as Spectre kind of indicated, there was a lot of back and forth between them and Valve with the actual bug bounty program, starting off with the initial report in 2022, July 11th. So fair enough, they send it there, and then Triage eventually, you know, acknowledges it within a few days, give them the repro steps, and then it looks like they had to prompt for HackerOne, Valve potentially, depending on whether or not this was being HackerOne's triage team or if it was being triaged by Valve, which I assume it was. But anyway, they didn't respond for a few months there, or a couple months, I guess, because that's in July. And then it's not until October where they ask for an answer where Triage says can't reproduce.
That's always the worst response to receive, like can't reproduce.
And especially so long after.
Yeah,
like that is, I mean, Valve has this reputation anyhow, especially back in 2022. They still definitely had that reputation of being quite a pain to work with on this. But yeah, they had a lot of back and forth here. They didn't want to deploy a server to show it, but H1 Triage asked to update to the latest CSGO release. Bug's still there. Triage validates it and sends to Valve remediation. They ask for an update. This is now getting to January of 2023. And then they ask for update. They do get a update saying there is no update. you know, 3 weeks later, they get that update. And then, you know, month later or half month later, they ask for another update. End of February, they ask for another update. get an update saying they're working on it. So they ask for an update in April now, end of April, where they finally get a reward. And then the fix doesn't happen for asking for updates about the fix. Ultimately, this thing kind of coming out where after October 16th of just this past year, they want to fully disclose the bug, and HackerOne warns that it's a violation of terms and asks them to wait until it's closed. And then a few months later.
That's just hilarious considering you can't even play CSGO anymore. Well, you kind of can through like a beta build, but not really. So this bug would be impossible. Like, even if someone wanted to use it as an end day out there or something against older CSGO clients, like, it's not even really viable for that. So, like, full disclosure of this bug is like about as safe as you can get for disclosing a vulnerability.
Yeah, but, although, like, I mean, that aspect could very well be a case of just their standard practice. Like, they don't allow the disclosure before this point, even though I don't think CSGO is even still part of the acceptable, like, sorry, the scope of the bounty project. No. Yeah, I believe it's removed from scope, although interestingly, I don't think CS2 has been added to scope yet. There's a reference to it, but it's not officially in like their scope list. So it sounds like they intend to, but they didn't actually update everywhere for it. I don't know. I didn't look into that. That was just something I was reading on Reddit from somebody wanting to work on CSGO, and that kind of came up. But yeah, a lot of back and forth. Valve is kind of known for this. And I completely neglected to mention that they did offer a reward of $750 for this finding, which I thought felt a little bit. Okay, I thought I might have skipped over it as I was going through the rest of the timeline. But yeah, they got a 750 bounty for it, which when it comes to a binary bounty, we often see a bit higher for this sort of thing. But they didn't take it to code execution, didn't prove it would be exploitable, that like they had objects to target or something.
That is also why I think the timeline is a little bit more excusable in this case. It probably wasn't marked as a priority where it wasn't taken to full exploit. And at one point in time, I remember CS, or Valve rather, had stopped accepting reports without full demonstration of exploitability. Because I've kind of said this before when we talked about Valve topics, and you had hinted at it earlier with the fact that their fuzzer had found so many different memory corruptions. But bugs shake out of Source Engine like leaves off trees in the fall. It's not hard to find memory corruption issues in Source Engine, even ones that are remotely hittable. What makes it difficult is the fact that it's so hard to get a remote info leak, and because of the mitigations that are in play, like ASLR and whatnot, you kind of have to have one in many cases, and that's what's really difficult. So the fact that they didn't take it to full exploit here, I think is probably part of why it took so long for it to get fixed, but it didn't get fixed. It ended up being like tossed out in favor of CS2 because that buggy code wasn't there anymore, that specific area. But yeah, I mean, that's probably why it wasn't a high priority issue.
Okay. I will say, I guess I was wrong about CSGO not being in the scope anymore. It is in the scope. I just pulled up the policy scopes for the Valve program, and they do have the CSGO.exe there. Do you know offhand what CSGO 2's binary is?
It's called CS2.exe.
Okay, then yeah, that's not in here. So but CS2 isn't in
scope. I'm guessing it's just, like, CSGO and CS2 are kind of used interchangeably, especially internally at Valve. Like, if you look in the Steam file system, it's CS2 still comes up under Counter-Strike Global Offensive, so it's somewhat interchangeable.
They specifically call out CSGO.exe. By marking
that, it also says last update 2017. So
I think that's just update of scope.
Yeah, but basically what I'm saying is added. I think this is overly pedantic. Like, I think if you reported an issue that impacted CS2, they would still accept it, even though it's technically not on their scope page.
Oh,
I think that's probably just a semantic difference.
So I think they could, although a really important thing is the fact that, you know, on H1, you do sometimes have, and this is managed by HackerOne also, you do sometimes have the triagers from HackerOne who are going to go look at the scope and be like, no, this is out of scope, close. And Valve isn't going to say, oh, we actually consider this to be equal or whatever, this isn't in scope. So you could run into issues like that on just the bounty programs being like that, even if they intend to accept it.
If you look in the exclusions page of their section of their policy page, it says that effective July 14th or whatever, CSGO is out of scope for new reports. Reports for CS2 limited tests are currently out of scope. So that was limited tests. I don't think it's not considered limited tests anymore, but...
Well, so that was the thing that I remember reading on scope was that it was, you know, reports for the limited tests of CS2 are currently out of scope, but they didn't update it to indicate, like, you know, now that it's not in scope. Either way, I mean, all I'm really getting at here is there are some questions about the scope and what they're going to accept or not. It feels like they would want the bugs in CS2, so I agree with you that odds are if they saw it, they would actually, you know, fix the issues and, like, they would treat it as in scope, just given the fact that it's basically, at least in my mind, one of Valve's flagship games. They have a number of games, but, like, in my mind, one of the main games I know from them is, you know, the Counter-Strike series, so makes sense.
CS2 there are some and questions. Dota 2 are their big things, yeah.
Yeah, the main reason...
Those are the big titles.
Main reason I actually wanted to bring this up, however, was just to see their payouts, to see where that $750 actually came in. And they do treat that as, like, for a medium, $750 is their... I'm not sure if this is max or base, but either way, $750 kind of fits in with what they offer as even the average bounty at the top of the page, $750. So fair enough. It's in line. I thought they paid out a little bit more, but maybe that was just an older thing, or maybe it's just, like I said, for the criticals, for the things that we can actually, you know, show are exploitable, probably get more on that. So yeah, I guess actually something I just see on here is they do have reduced severity where it's a community server to client attack, which is exactly what this is, including malicious maps and textures from a community server. So that would also bring it down. So fair enough. Learning about the scope as we go here a little bit.
And that makes sense. Where a community server, we kind of skipped over that when we were talking about the bounty aspect of it, but the fact that you have to enable SV enable allow uploads is a fairly big factor to consider, that it would have to be like surf servers or something like that, not just your typical everyday community server. So that's a fair thing to call out as well.
Yeah, they made it sound like, so I haven't played like in any community servers, I haven't played CSGO. They made it sound like it wasn't uncommon though for community servers to want you to allow that downloading, although maybe that's just specific types of community servers that would do that. It sounded to me like it wasn't too uncommon for somebody who played on community servers to have it enabled, but maybe
it's mostly going to be servers with custom assets. So like surf servers will commonly have like completely custom maps and models and things like that, or like ones like that, whereas practice servers where it's just like a DM or whatever, like that's probably not going to use custom assets, and so you wouldn't need the SV allow upload change. So yeah, it depends on what type of community servers you would be using.
Okay, so I understand kind of the word just DM and practice server. What's a surf server?
That's where you I'm trying to figure out the,
like,
best
is that
way to,
like,
explain
the
it.
Custom game, like some sort of custom game,
it's
mode,
like a custom
sort of
game mode. Yeah, so the idea is you don't have like any weapons other than your knife, and you're basically skating along the map, so they'll have like ramps that you have to
surf,
use your
specific
movement. Yeah, you use your movement to try to navigate through these like mazes of ramps, and that's surfing. It's fairly popular, especially in like influencer spheres and whatnot. But yeah, it's pretty different from like the core game.
Yeah, okay. Because yeah, you're saying surf, and I'm just thinking, well, initially I was almost imagining like sea surf because we talk it up so much, but that makes no sense in this context. So my next thought goes to
surfing. With her moving, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. I just, you know, never heard it before.
Yeah, that's
fair. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, I think this, the bug itself here, it's kind of fun. Like I said, I like seeing the fact they're doing this as part of an internship, as one of their side projects, I guess. But the fact that they're doing that, they're being given the time to do this research, I appreciate seeing that and at least give it a bit of a shout out for having a finding and at least taking it through to, I mean, I think they still take it to a proof of concept here. So, you know, they've got something like they get, I guess I say they take it too, but you kind of get that with a fuzzer. You get a proof of concept a lot of the time, so fair enough. But yeah, I don't know. I think we've talked about this one longer than I actually expected to.
Yeah, and I will say, kind of like what I said at the top of the topic, even though the vulnerability is in like a dead area, and they might not have taken it the full exploit. I think some of the stuff towards the top of the post where they talk about the attack surface overview is still very much relevant. You still have the connectionless messages, the network channels, all these messages that they talk about, like those are still going to be there. Maybe there is some that aren't, like that got deprecated and aren't there anymore, or some newer ones or whatever, but overall the high level overview that they give here is still a good resource. So
yeah, definitely seems like it could be worthwhile. Have to take a look and make sure that it's being used with CS2 or with something else, but I guess there are other games still active on Source, aren't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, so fair enough. Like, it's still there and still, you know, usable information. Especially, actually, I think for other bugs that play your avatar, that is a heap string primitive. Sounds like it's a pretty powerful primitive. Could be very useful in other exploits, just knowing that fact. I'm not sure if it's a novel thing, but the way they're presenting it here is that just something that they went through to discover. So, I mean, sounds like that's a very useful primitive. Pretty much any case where you need a heap spray. I mean, attacker controlled arbitrary bytes except for the first 32 bits. Sounds like that's at least useful. There's useful stuff in here regardless.
All right, so getting into another game issue that we have in the episode, we have a Factorio vulnerability. This was pretty cool to see because I play Factorio quite a bit, as some in our Discord might have noticed. So yeah, this was posted by Valentin Metz, and as you can probably guess, it is a save game based issue. They talk a little bit about reversing the Factorio binary and reversing its loading of save game data. Luckily, they have symbols and debugging information, so that it wasn't too difficult to reverse. Those weren't stripped out, which is not very surprising because Factorio devs are pretty open. I've even seen them occasionally stream them writing code and like working on the game's code base. And they also have like an open supported mod community. Like they're a very open dev team. So it's not surprising that they wouldn't strip out the debugging information here. Getting into the vulnerability though, the bug they found is in the loading of the property tree from the save game, where it'll take a data length from the save as an unsigned int, add one to it to allocate a buffer to pre-allocate the buffer to hold the property tree data, and then read it in. And as you can imagine, with that add one, there's an int overflow there where the value will wrap back to zero if you provide a really high value. And it turns out that Factorio's new allocator on a size of zero will basically just add one to the size and allocate it instead of rejecting it, which results in a buffer of 1 byte in size. And when it goes to read the file data using the unchanged data size, it overflows. Because of the fact that this is a 32-bit value, it does result in needing to have the save that's 4 gigabytes in size, though that doesn't seem to be a huge problem. I will say in my playthroughs, I don't think any of my saves are even close to that large, but people do some crazy stuff in Factorio, so it's not a super unreasonable save size. Exploiting it is also pretty straightforward. The Factorio binary isn't compiled as position independent. You can simply set up a controlled pointer to hijack the instruction pointer and drop from there. The exploit and vulnerability isn't too complicated or anything, but I wanted to talk about it because I do love Factorio, as you know, like I said, people have probably seen. And in general, it is a popular game with developers and reverse engineers and exploit devs. So that made it pretty cool. And the Factorio devs actually had commented on fixing this issue and some things around it on Reddit as well. I don't have those immediately available, but I'll add those as reference links for the show notes if anyone's curious. But yeah, just kind of a fun thing. Nothing super crazy with the Vulner exploit, though.
Yeah, I mean, one of the questions I kind of had on this one, actually, was that they kind of mentioned getting two crashes here. It sounds like these two crashes just happened with their, you know, they give it the... So their first step in trying to exploit this was creating a non-repeating pattern that they put into the save file. So 4 gigabytes of that big save file, get that load. And then they had multiple crashes in multiple threads. So like a crash in one, usually I thought would bring down everything with threads because these aren't separate processes. So they mentioned kind of having one crash here. And then if they keep going, they're getting another crash. So could be something with their handling, but... One option here is that they very easily were able to adjust their input, so there was no crash. The other option could be that the exploitable one just happens first, so when they kind of hijack things, they're able to clean up, maybe, or kill other threads and just kind of have their, you know, main thread, or they don't care because they execute something else early. Actually, yeah, because their exploit does just do an exev on bin git flag, which I kind of appreciate. Like, I'm not sure if I have that binary installed, but it's a proof of concept. Fair enough. Always got to get the flag. But they do that, which is going to replace the entire address space. So those old threads aren't going to matter anymore. But yeah, it just stood out to me that they had kind of the multiple crashes here, and it sounded like these were happening like in the same area. Like, it wasn't something they could just avoid by doing a different trigger or something. They have the one trigger and these multiple crashes. So stood out to me. There very well could just be like, I guess they could probably have a way of recovering on it. I just would have thought, you know, once they get that seg fault, it would have just failed there.
Yeah, my guess is they get the code execution before they become a problem and are able to set up a handle or something to deal with it. Or, like you said, they were just able to craft their payload in such a way that those other crashes didn't happen. They don't seem to comment too much on it, so we can only guess, but
yeah, like, I think those are reasonable assumptions. Doesn't sound like it was any sort of issue to them, because they don't bring it up as something they really need to care about. It's just, as I was reading this, I'm thinking, like, well, shouldn't the crash bring things down? Of course, inside of a game engine, I wouldn't be surprised if they had some sort of processing going on to, like, try and recover or, like, do something with that. Like, it's at least feasible to me within that sort of context. It just wouldn't necessarily fail directly, but yeah, it just stood out to me. It was kind of a question I had going through here. And yeah, their exploit's pretty straightforward. From that second crash, they had an indirect call with more or less controllable address. And ROP. Always got to have ROP.
So getting into a more complicated vulnerability, we do have a Linux kernel bug in the episode as well, which is an IOU ring issue that was reported by Jan Horn on Project Zero. So yeah, this is pretty similar to a previous issue that we covered in IOU ring back in December, episode 226. So it's fairly similar to that bug. And of course, it's IOU ring, which we've covered so many times, but here it is again. So I'll let Z get into it.
Yeah, it is IOU ring, although I don't want to spend too much time really talking about the specifics of IOU ring and what it's trying to do here, because it is getting into, like, the bug title here is that IOU adder map, so mapping a user address into the IO ring handles multi-page regen dangerously. So you're kind of getting into some of the lower level aspects of memory management that I don't want to talk a lot about. But the core issue kind of comes in two places. The key thing that it's trying to do is that, as I said, it's going to take a user-based address, it's going to take, you know, some pages, and it'll potentially map that into a ring. If it's like a single page, you know, if they have a comment here that this is normally going to be just a single page, and if the ring's small enough, they could use just a normal page, they're fine. But if they need multiple pages, the main thing that they want is that they need to be contiguous memory. And then they kind of misunderstand how, in a sense, they're misunderstanding how user space and their virtual addresses work. And they're also misunderstanding the return of this pin user pages fast call here. So main thing that kind of happens here, pin user pages fast is going to return, the actual return value itself is the number of pages that it actually pinned. And then it also has the page array, and that is a out var, so, or now pointer, where it's just going to write out pointers to the pages. So then they take that and they take a look at these pages that they tried. Or first thing they do is they just check, did we map all of the pages we were given? So they also have this NR pages. Is that equal to our return value? And if something went wrong and they come map some pages, they just bail. And then the other case is down here. They kind of go and compare, assuming that if they have kind of the multiple pages, they would expect that the first page or index zero is going to be equal to the last page pointer in that array, which generally isn't actually going to be true, because you have contiguous pages. The page pointers are like every page gets its own pointer, so, or gets its own like page structure, which will have its own pointer. And thus the check doesn't really work. And that's called out in the post here that, like, you know, this check is just wrong for two reasons. And what I'm talking about is the second point. It misunderstands how compound pages are represented. And then the first issue is just the fact that in user space, like, you can create a mapping of pages in like that virtual address space that will start and end with the same page. And then in the middle of those pages, you could have some other page mapped in there. It doesn't guarantee that it's all contiguous, but its check is only looking for that first and last page to be the same. So user space can actually get around this, and legitimate code that would be okay will just fail.
It's a very naive check. And yeah, like that thing with being able to have the first and last page go to the same physical page, that's just because you can have multiple virtual pages that map to the same physical page. That's something that's very useful to have. Again, I won't go into too much of the paging, like you said, but it's very just naive with just only checking the first and last and just assuming the rest that are in the middle are going to be in the middle, like fit between the two different pages. But that's not a reasonable assumption. That can be broken.
Yeah, and the problem with this is just that because it thinks those pages are all going to be like contiguous and together, when it does allow it to be accessed in through IOU ring and maps it in there and tries to access, it's going to access it as an offset from that first page. And so if you give it an offset larger than the page, it's going to go into the next page over, and it's going to access it, or it's going to access pages that it shouldn't be accessing, including potentially read-only pages or something like that too. So pretty powerful bug there. So I didn't want to spend too long on, you know, the internals, but it's just the reminder that just because the developer does something, they usually know the code pretty well. But when you're dealing with random systems, sometimes you make assumptions that just aren't correct. And it's always worth trying to validate assumptions that developers make. Because in this case, it comes down to just not quite understanding how pages get represented in this case, and writing code based off of that false assumption, which is something you'll see elsewhere. In this case, it's a bad check in a very deep area, but, and you would also think that, you know, maybe this sort of bad check would be caught really quickly, but actually, I'm not sure how old this code was. Let me just check the blame quickly.
Yeah, with IOU ring, it's, you can't make assumptions.
Yeah, because it's under active development, so it's probably not that old. Looks like it's about 8 months old.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, fair enough. Not the oldest thing out there, but these checks can sometimes survive and not really be caught really quickly because, you know, in this case, it's just failing, saying, like, that's not supported. So, you know, they figure out another way to do what they're trying to and don't realize that actually it should allow this. Just, it doesn't, because it will just return, like, error invalid or whatever. It couldn't do it. As somebody using the API, I'd just be like, okay, well, I've got to find another way to do this then, or, like, this isn't working, doesn't like it, and I'd move on and wouldn't necessarily think, oh, this is a really core bug because it doesn't cause a crash or anything unless you actually set up the call in the proper way. So I don't know. It's one of those cases, again, don't necessarily need to think about all the deep paging aspects of this, just incorrect checks. Let these kind of subtle bugs come through that can be very powerful. And like this ability to work on read-only pages, that could be a very useful primitive to have.
It's a good reminder to, like, when you're auditing code, to make sure that the check is actually performing what it's intending to do, because it's very easy, and I fall into this trap too, where you'll glance through code and you'll see a check and a comment, and you just kind of automatically assume, okay, they're checking for this, move on to something else.
Yeah.
It's easy, like, to just like skip over that.
Yeah, like what you'll kind of read is, okay, they check the bounds, they check this. And I mean, this isn't a bounds case exactly, but like you'll kind of read the code and just skip over what they're logically doing and not necessarily focus on the specifics of it.
Yeah, it's easy to get into this headspace where you're trying to think of things that the developer hasn't, but you also need to check that the implementation of what they were trying to do is done correctly, even if they did think of it. So this is a good reminder for that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I liked out of this bug, because there were some other IOU ring bugs that I don't even want to get into that are just kind of too deep to, are too technical to really apply elsewhere. But this, I feel like, you know, even if you don't understand the paging, you can get that idea out of it.
Yeah. All right, so our last topic is a post by ODS Security, and it's on a secure boot bypass in Chromecast with the Google TV, which includes some hardware hacking as well. So we love to see that when it comes around. This is off the back of some previous research they did with the Sabrina model, which was the 4K model. This is the 1080p model, which is a newer revision. That original 4K model, they had an exploit chain that leveraged a boot ROM bug and a bug to gain persistence in the bootloader through modifying the environment's lock value. by setting that to a specific like binary pattern, you were able to disable the signature verification of the bootloader and load custom binaries. So those bugs were fixed. They needed some new bugs. But not only were the bugs fixed, Google also did some additional mitigation work on the serial side of things and on a few other things. So, for example, previously you could interrupt the boot sequence to get a U-boot shell during the bootloader execution, which allowed them to do things like modifying the environment. Although now they set this config auto boot delay value in U-boot to make it harder to interrupt the boot sequence. And they also state that Android shell itself isn't accessible as the Android console service isn't even started yet at this point. So that was the first thing they had to figure out. And they did find a way to get a U-boot shell. They don't go into too much detail on it in this post, and this is where the hardware hacking sort of comes into play. But they found that by shorting the embedded multimedia card, or eMMC's DAT5 pin, at a specific time in the boot, they could basically fault inject it to have the boot pause, which would allow them to access a U-boot shell sort of like before. It would inject a delay, so to speak. Once they had that shell, they tried a similar trick as before, where they try to set that lock environment variable to value to change it. But they ended up discovering that there was more work done to mitigate that angle too. One of the other changes they made is that you can't change environment variables related to the lock state unless the device is marked as a developer board. And the way they determine if it's a developer board is by reading the on-die fuses. It's kind of funny, they actually double read the on-die fuses because they're worried about like fault injection around that as well. So that's not something you're easily going to be able to get around through software. Luckily though, they were able to find a bug in the update functionality, specifically where it temporarily disables Android verified boot in order to perform updates. And this was a logic bug right near the top of their code snippet. So bring it up here. The code will initialize ABB, and then it'll fetch this upgrade step variable from the environment. And it has this check where if the device is unlocked or the upgrade step is equal to 3, they set the flags necessary to allow verification errors, essentially bypassing verification of further boot stages. The authors of this post called out that this is probably a logical operator misuse, where the OR wasn't meant to be used here. I'm guessing it should have been an AND. And this is significant because with the U-boot shell, the attacker can control that upgrade step value in the environment. So by simply setting it to 3 and continuing the boot process, it'll allow the verification errors, return a success on load, and thus will allow loading arbitrary unsigned data with no indicator that the boot integrity was violated. So this in its own is pretty cool, but they wanted to see if they could make it persistent. For that, they took advantage of another sort of issue.
Just before you go on to that bug, sorry, I tried talking, but I was muted and didn't realize for a moment. But anyway, with this bug there, I do kind of appreciate the fact that the code, like if you just read it, it's just like, if the device is unlocked, okay, that's the secure thing. Or if there's a value attackers can control is set to this. Like it's just, if you read it, you can see something is very wrong here. And I don't know, it just stands out that, like, and it's doing the same thing on that case. So you know, like, this is an important thing. It's not just, like, some random flag that doesn't matter. Like, I suppose it could. It's probably set somewhere that could be checked, but I don't know. It's a fun issue to see in there because it is very much, like I said, that logical operator, just misuse, misthinking about what you're doing. But if you just read that as a human, if the device is unlocked or this controllable string is 3, like, it just stands out kind of very clearly when you understand that it's, and they're reading it from the environment, literally the line above. So there isn't that big, or at least in this display of the code, there isn't that big disconnect. I don't know if anything's been removed here for readability.
What it indicates for me is that when a lot of this original code was written, the environment wasn't treated as untrusted. That's kind of what I'm getting from this type of bug appearing, because like they demonstrated with the previous model that the environment shouldn't be trusted with being able to change the lock state. So it seems like they were like, okay, we got to mitigate that. So we'll do this check in trying to change the lock state. But there's a bunch of other environment variables that are used that could be potentially dangerous on depending on the context. Like,
yeah, that's a fair show that like they do have to use kind of the trickery in order to even get to set the environment. So yeah, fair point.
Yeah. So, like I said, that in its own is pretty cool. They did want to see if they could make it persistent. For that, they took advantage of what, in my opinion, is another issue. And that's the fact that U-boot will load this bootloader control block, or BCB, from the MISC partition, which is basically just a block of data that's passed directly to the U-boot shell. And they found that this BCB is not checked at all, really. Like, it doesn't seem to be signed or any, like, integrity checks on it. So they can pass in that setenv upgrade step 3 command in there, disable AVB for the next boot, and then in the init script, just continue setting that variable up for each subsequent boot to have a persistent root on the device. So, yeah, as much as there is, like, a bit of a low-level aspect to it, and there is a bit of hardware hacking, the vulnerabilities here are very understandable. They're just, like, logical issues and just not checking, like, not checking input data or trusting it where they shouldn't be.
Feels kind of, you know, standard when we talk about a lot of these embedded devices. They have these, you know, kind of issues, although, you know, this isn't just, like, a stupid, like, they copy a buffer without checking the size or something. This is at least a bit more of a logical issue, but yeah, no, I didn't really think about, but yeah, I do think you're right about the fact that, you know, just the environment was more or less trusted at one point, and now they recognize, hey, maybe we shouldn't trust this because there's a chance they get access, and it's just kind of a legacy of that.
Yeah, something that's going to take some time to rewind or mitigate properly. So
yeah, to fully figure out.
Yeah. So it was cool that they were able to take advantage of this in this way. It does kind of fit into that, you know, rooting of, like, console hacking sort of a idea. I wish, like, the kind of consoles that I look at were as relatively easy to get, like, because one thing they talk about too is the fact that where they're using U-Boot and everything, they are bound by license to disclose source. So that makes researching this a little bit easier than what you would see in a lot of, like, embedded devices. But yeah, it's a really cool chain, and it's cool they were able to pop Google TV like this.
Yeah, and so, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just about to wrap it up, so if you have a comment there, go ahead.
I was just going to talk about the timeline, actually, a little bit here. Not so much the actual timeline in terms of how long it took, because a lot of it is, like, you know, Google asked for a bit longer, so, like, low-level things from the low-level components can be patched by vendors, so, like, I don't really blame Google for vendors being slow and slower than Google. But I did find it interesting that Google offered to sponsor their team to attend the hardware.io con in the Netherlands last year.
That was really cool.
I thought that was a neat thing that they offer there, because I haven't seen that as a Google bug bounty offering before. So yeah, I'm not sure kind of what source that exactly, but I did find that an interesting aspect of it.
Yeah, I agree. And they talk a little bit about not necessarily collision. On the EMMC fault injection, there was kind of collision with Thomas Roth, who gives trainings at Hardware.io. But yeah, like, Google had kind of created the connection there too with stack smashing. And yeah, it's just Google in general seems pretty cool when you go through, like, their disclosure process. They're generally pretty good with their researchers that report stuff to them.
Yeah, I haven't heard a lot of complaints out of Google's bug bounty at all.
Yeah. And speaking of Google's bounty, we can get into some of our shoutouts. So our first one here is a V8 capture the flag write-up. So this is taking advantage of V8 CTF, which we have talked about previously. We didn't want to do full coverage of this topic because it is very specific to V8. And quite frankly, I don't understand all the intricate details that are involved here because it's in the, like, caching area, which I haven't looked at in the bit of browser exploitation I've done. But it's significant because, as I say, it's capturing the first flag in that CTF. So
yeah, I'm not sure if this is actually first blood for all of the CTF, but this is the first time that I've seen somebody do a write-up against the new V8 CTF, which was, we just talked about it on, like, the 10th of October was the release for the episode 218 we mentioned. Yeah, I figured it was still interesting. See, it looks like he does go into a good deal of details similar to Spectre. Like, this is in the inline cache component. I barely know what it's talking about. I tried reading it, actually, and just kind of had to admit that, like with a lot of browser stuff, it's just outside of my wheelhouse. Nonetheless, looks like a good write-up. This was a blog, you know, I followed for some of their other write-ups, and they have mostly CTF stuff. But I've seen them before, had some interesting reads out of it. So, I mean, I figured this will probably be of similar quality in there. I just am not able to judge it myself. But at least it's a shout out. And again, interesting to see it hit that V8 CTF.
And it's a good reminder about V8 CTF because this write up.
Well, it's brand new. Who needs a reminder yet?
Well, no, what I mean is the specifics about V8CTF, because this write up is exploiting a already known bug. But V8CTF will reward successful exploitation attempts against like known issues. So that's a pretty rare thing. Like most bounties will not accept known issues and just exploiting them, but V8CTF does. So, like KCTF does too, for kernel, but like V8 and KCTF are kind of unique in that aspect. So if you are interested more in the exploit dev side of things and not so much on the VR side, these are avenues that you could explore. Though like V8 is a really hard target to get into, but if you're really into the exploit dev, it's something to consider.
At the very least, I think it could be good motivation if you are wanting to get into kind of the upper end of like the V8 exploitation. You know, as you're getting started, we often talk about, you know, trying to reproduce bugs and then trying to take like a known bug that doesn't have an exploit and trying to create the exploit for it. So you're able to have your choice of bugs here. And the main thing that, you know, V8CTF, KCTF, and I'm not sure if they've actually released it yet, but KVMCTF, is that, like I said, they're focused on the exploitation and specifically more interested in novel exploitation strategies, which, especially if you're coming at it new, you could go the path of learning like all the common techniques. And I think it's important to get that background of how people are solving the issues, but you're also able to bring fresh eyes and come with your own ideas and find your own strategies. So I think it's a great thing when you're trying to, or it could be a great thing when you're trying to learn on a particular target that they have the CTF for. But I think we went over a lot of that back when we were just talking about the announcement for V8 and KVM CTFs. So yeah, I can't think of any other bounty program like it.
Yeah, it's really cool for people who are into the exploit dev.
Yeah.
Yep, and our last shout out is one that Z had found, and it's this Exploits Club mailing list. So this sounds like it would be something that would be pretty interesting to a lot of people who listen to the Binary podcast, as it's a newsletter targeted specifically for that. So I'll let Z talk about this for a minute and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, it seems like it's coming out every week. They just started. I actually meant to bring this up a little bit ago and kind of forgot last week, but yeah, it's just kind of links. So it's a lot of the types of links that we might also talk about. They do include the vulnerabilities. They have a bit more that cuts on, I guess, related areas like reverse engineering, what the post here is on, decompilation, but things that would be interesting to those of us actually doing like low-level vulnerability research and exploit development. So I actually recommend taking a look at them. They find some great stuff, and I do appreciate that they include the interesting job postings. I'm not looking for a new job at this point, but I kind of like seeing what's being hired, what they're asking for, and they're finding a lot of those, you know, kind of lower level jobs. Like they have, you know, an offer here, hardware VR from at Google or on the Morse team at Microsoft, Raytheon, and then even calling out like anti-cheat work at Ubisoft. But, you know, they have a few options there that could be interesting, I think, to people that are doing this low level. So I want to at least give them a quick shout out here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a quick, nice read to, like, get up to speed on what's going on with what we try to do on the podcast, basically.
Yeah, and I think they're doing a pretty good job of finding topics that you might have missed, because I think last week, actually, we ended up covering a vulnerability that I saw from their exploit, from their last week post. And this week, actually, they came across this Syspwn, a YouTube, which I haven't yet watched, but they have a interview with someone who is working on Pwn2Own targets. Seems like Syspwn is focused on Pwn2Own and talking to people. They also had Alex Blaskett on. We've covered a bunch of write-ups from him before. They had him on like 4 months ago, and that's their only two episodes. It's like a really small channel that they were able to come across, and very relevant, I think, to the vulnerability research. They're doing Pwn2Own stuff, so makes sense. But they're finding resources, so. Yeah, keep your eye on them, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, like you said before, it's always been a bit of a challenge to get good aggregation of topics for low level. Like, that's part of the reason we had launched OdayFans. So this is kind of fulfilling that as well. And some really good stuff in here. So hopefully the newsletter keeps going and can check it out every week.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's all the topics that we have for today. So as always, thanks everyone who tuned in. You can find previous episodes on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Feel free to join the community. You can do that by joining the Discord and Twitter links that are in the description. And we'll see you next week.